Hello, and welcome to the Logistics Management Podcast Series. My name's Jeff Berman. I'm Group News Editor for Logistics Management Magazine and the Peerless Media Supply Chain Group. It's a real pleasure today to welcome Chris Connor to our podcast. Chris serves as President and CEO of the American Association of Port Authorities, also known as the AAPA, which is located down in Alexandria, Virginia. Chris officially took over the helm at the AAPA back in October 2019. Chris was previously Global President and CEO of Wallenius Wilmington Logistics AS, one of the world's largest ocean car carriers and vehicle logistics groups. As CEO, he guided the company through a period of significant transformation in its core ocean transport business while driving rapid growth in the vehicle logistics arena. Chris also has more than 38 years of experience in international shipping and logistics, and he began his career at United States Lines in 1981, followed by Crawley Maritime in 1987, prior to joining Wallenius Lines back in 1994. Chris is a member of the National Association of Corporate Directors, where he earned a Board Governance Fellowship designation in March 2017. He's also served as a keynote speaker and panelist for several national summits, including the Automotive Supply Chain Congress and the Economist World Ocean Summit. Hey, Chris, welcome to our podcast.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real pleasure to have you here with us, Chris. And it's pretty timely, too, given that this week is United for Infrastructure Week. And that's impacting your organization, the AAPA, on a number of fronts. So I just wanted to, with that as a backdrop, I just wanted to start with some recent news, Chris. Earlier this week, you testified before the United States Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation Subcommittee on Surface Transportation, Maritime Freight, and Ports. That's a bunch of words there.
Sure is.
At a hearing on freight, rail, and trucking. So I just want to, just so our audience can get a bit of insight here, Chris, what were sort of the key objectives of that hearing, and what were the key points and themes that you addressed yourself in your comments?
Sure. So, I mean, I would say part of the, you know, the legislative process, to put it that way, is that these committees of jurisdiction will convene, they'll ask, you know, expert witnesses, you know, people from industry to comment on the state of their respective areas of expertise. So in this context, you know, we had myself representing the ports. We had the head of the American Trucking Association, the head of the Short Line Railroad, and someone representing the Teamsters Union. All of this, it was billed, you know, focus on freight mobility, but it was really spurred by the fact that the FAST Act, which is one of the key pieces of legislation that funds highway programs and other programs in our country, is up for reauthorization in September of this year. And probably most significantly, you know, the undercurrent behind all this is the pending infrastructure packages that are now being discussed, both what's come out of the White House and what's been sort of counter-proposed by the Republicans.
Yes.
So to your point, things that I talked about from a port perspective relative to the FAST Act is we asked that in any reauthorization of the FAST Act that freight program funding be made 100% multimodal, that the 10% state cap that exists today for build grants, it's now called RAISE, but it's the build program, be lifted. That just bids one mode of transportation in a particular state against another and puts an artificial cap on any one state. Thirdly, that freight planning through state freight plans continue, and that we kind of have an elevated national freight strategic plan. And finally, that within the Department of Transportation, an Office of Freight and Multimodal Infrastructure Policy be established.
That would be a great idea to have that type of office. I think it's something that's been really in need, especially in recent years. That's great. And Chris, keeping with recent events, later today being Thursday, May 13th, You, along with several other port CEOs, will be co-hosting a panel discussion with the U.S. Committee on the Maritime Transportation System, discussing how infrastructure supports the marine supply chain with an emphasis on climate resilience, intermodal rail connectivity, service for agriculture, and the economic benefits of healthy port infrastructure. There's a lot going on there with sort of the trends and themes that are being addressed. What are sort of the goals or objectives of what you guys have cooking later today?
Yeah, that's it. So that that event will be is a partnership between AAPA and CMTS. And anecdotally, I would say CMTS had done a great study where they their evaluation was that, you know, $1 of investment in maritime infrastructure has an economic impact that pays back 2 to 3 times. But what that conversation is all about is really what we're seeking. I think the industry is quite frankly thrilled that the Biden administration and the Republicans in their counter proposal are actually mentioning ports. I mean, yeah. It was a grand day when Joe Biden as a candidate and then Joe Biden as president-elect, and now he in the White House, as well as Secretary Buttigieg, are specifically mentioning ports. That was a word we didn't hear. We always heard about highways, bridges, tunnels, schools, all very important, but never did we hear about ports. So this conversation today is really about the four key things that we're seeking in this infrastructure package. And that is $20 billion for deep draft port infrastructure and intermodal freight connectors, funding for electrification of dockside ship connections and zero emission port equipment, $6 billion for the Corps of Engineers Coastal Navigation Program to complete already started programs or start programs that are awaiting funding, and then $500 million for port development of offshore wind energy in order to catalyze that evolution at scale. So there's been some good dollar amounts mentioned in both the president's program and in the Republicans' counterproposal. It doesn't quite match up with what we're asking for. So we're trying to thread that needle between being, you know, grateful and appreciative that the administration and the Republicans, the minority party, are talking about the same thing. But we're also trying to highlight that the need is greater, and the need is greater because there's been such a lack of infrastructure investment over the last generation. And I would call it a significant lack of investment in our port and maritime infrastructure. So now's the moment, and we're just trying to be crystal clear about what the needs are.
Okay, that's great. And so I'm assuming a lot of what you just mentioned was also mentioned and cited in a recent letter sent by the AAPA to President Biden, reflecting on the American Jobs Plan and highlighting specific port infrastructure investment needs. Is it fair to say there's a bit of overlap with what you just told me and what was within the contents of that letter?
Absolutely. I mean, they're complementary, and that was our way of saying, you know, thank you, President Biden, for putting ports on the radar screen here. And then sort of raising, you know, as if in a card game, if you will, but kind of going up, raising the stakes a little bit and just making them aware of how great the need is.
Okay. All right. Great. Great. You know, when last time we talked, Chris, we chatted a bit about the recently issued World Bank Container Port Performance Index. And U.S. ports, I guess, did not shine in that. I believe they had a ranking, worldwide ranking, I believe, of 53. And that just sort of speaks, which is odd, you know, right? When you consider that we have some of the highest volume ports globally anywhere, you know, what it kind of speaks to the need for these infrastructure upgrades and needs. What sort of AAPA's perspective on that recent report?
Sure. I was able to speak to that in response to a question that I was asked by one of the senators during the hearing. So you're right. It was the World Bank and IHS Market produced this report. They based it. They surveyed 351 of the world's largest container ports. The criteria was based on dwell time, and they consider to be dwell time a function of two things, port infrastructure and processes of the operators on the port. The top ranked U.S. port of the 351 ports surveyed was ranked 53 in the survey. The second best U.S. port was ranked number 87. So I think there's two things in my mind that really scream out from that. We're getting beat on the infrastructure spending side. And, mm-hmm. and the ports leading the way in that survey were Asian, largely Asian ports, and a high number of Chinese ports. So we're getting outspent, out-prioritized by other sovereign nations in terms of public spending on port infrastructure. That's one important dynamic. I think the other thing that's important here is we are also not operating, let's say, the same way. And I'll take China just because it's a nice big target to talk about. But, you know, ships in China are being loaded and unloaded around the clock. We do the same thing here. But cargo is being moved in and out of terminals. So you can deliver in for an export out of a Chinese port, 7x24. That's not true here. So we're being fed by a system that's 7x24 into a system that's only partially 7x24. Mm-hmm. So you can just imagine at some point, you know, the wheels stop or they start to move a lot slower because you don't have matching production systems at both sides. So I think those are the two functions that scream out in that report. Spending and, you know, let's call it on the process side.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, certainly it speaks a lot to port throughput there. And hopefully we can see some gains looking ahead. So, Chris, you know, we really obviously need to address the ongoing state of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then, you know, you joined the AAPA in advance of the outset of the pandemic by a few months anyhow. So you've had a pretty clear perspective since then. So I guess what I wanted to ask is sort of looking back, and I guess looking back, we'll use March 2020 as a point of reference. What would you view as the biggest changes going back to then? In to present day now in May 2020, in terms of things like lessons learned, how things have evolved port wise going back to when COVID really kicked in?
Yeah, you know, when I came into the job, you know, a lot of the things I heard about, of course, I was familiar with the port space because, as you mentioned in your opening comments, you know, I've been around the port industry for a long time and yeah. Although never worked directly for a port. myself, but you know, I was informed of call it the hyper competitive nature between ports competing for cargo, and I have no reason to believe that wasn't absolutely true. What I found impressive and made me feel really good about the choice I made to come into this role was, you know, when the pressure was really on, and when especially in the early stages of the pandemic, when we were all struggling just to find out and understand, you know, the significance and the seriousness of this virus. And on a more practical level, when it comes to ports, what it was doing to port activity, the rules of engagement, protocols. What I saw happen was an enormous outpouring of collaboration and cooperation between the port industry players. And it was not about my market share, what cargo I have that you don't have. It was all about what can we do collaboratively to make sure that essential goods and supplies are reaching the front lines of the pandemic, you know, first and foremost. And then secondly, to make sure that consumer goods, particularly in an environment where so many, you know, office workers were now working from homes, that consumer goods could reach store shelves, if not front doors of people's homes. And it was awesome. I have to say, it was awesome to see that kind of spirit The other thing was health and safety of port workers and an immediate focus on getting the designation of port workers as essential workers to allow them to work their jobs and go to their place of employment, which is obviously on the docks where the ships were being loaded and unloaded. That was a focus area that we zeroed in on quickly and with a lot of interest from a lot of parties, we were able to get that in place. So I think people quickly realized the power of just being united on something and speeding up that acclimation process to a whole new environment. I think now, if you sort of shift over to today's scenario, for many ports, but I have to say, not all ports are enjoying this resurgence that, you know, is taking up many of the news headlines. But of course, you know, it's now about how to manage, you know, this significantly consumer-driven, you know, buying surges and supply chain challenges that exist, and to manage through that. I think the appearance, you know, the optics of all the headlines would suggest that it's, you know, heady days for the port industry and the ports are rolling in money. I think if you peel back that onion a little bit, you'll find that while it's true that cargo volumes at many ports, but not all ports, have increased significantly, the cost of doing business because of the health and safety protocols, because of the worker shortages, because of their own challenges with COVID-19, are really high. And it sort of belies the headline of the surging import volumes that suggest big time profits.
No question. And we'll talk about the elevated state of imports in just a second, Chris, but it just got me thinking. As an aside, I remember not that long ago, the leadership over at the FMC, the Federal Maritime Commission, had penned a letter to the president expressing the need for port workers to sort of be bumped up in terms of priority for getting vaccinated. It makes all the sense in the world. And I'm just wondering sort of what your take was on that and perhaps what the state of progress is on that as well.
Sure. And we did the same. And I think what happened, and a legacy from the prior administration into the new administration, but by the time the new administration had gotten in place, the responsibility for port workers' designation for vaccination had become a state issue. So we pivoted, wrote to all the relevant governors, you know, anyone that had any connection to maritime activity in any way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. and encouraged them to up the prioritization level of port workers. I would say we had mixed success, to be honest with you. In the early stages, we got bumped up in some cases, others not. You know, the reality is right now, if you read the daily news, is there's plenty of vaccines available in most places around the country. And the emphasis has sort of changed from, you know, finding out where to get vaccinated if you so desire, to encouraging people who should get vaccinated, who perhaps aren't, you know, all the way there yet. But it became a state issue to control. You could debate whether that was the wisest, because then you end up having 50 different plans in 50 different states. Sure. But that's where we were by the time the vaccines were ready to go.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. And then shifting back to the import push, obviously we're seeing records at many ports across the country, especially out at the San Pedro Bay complex of LA and Long Beach, you know, clearly driven by the onslaught of e-commerce activity, you know, the whole, it's kind of a chain of events, right? But one big theme related to that has been the state of port congestion. I know things are slowly improving with not as many vessels berthed outside ports waiting to drop off their cargo. But how would you assess sort of what's going on at this point as it relates to that stuff?
Yeah, I think you're correct in what you said. It is improving. You know, indications are that congestion will continue, you know, into the summer. I would argue that in the past, these kind of congestion issues have been single event driven. For example, the insolvency of Hanjin a few years back, which created this, you know, massive backlog, albeit short term. Similarly, when there's work stoppage, you know, a few years back before that on the West Coast, similar kind of backup. So they're single event driven. And as soon as that event is over, things tend to smooth out. I'm not so sure that's going to be the case this time around. You know, I think these buying habits of American consumers are significantly changed. And it exposes some, you know, some challenges that we have. And it all comes back to investment in infrastructure. But if I could lay out for you, you know, the ingredients sort of how we got to this port congestion picture, I think there's probably seven key things. You have the spending extremes of the U.S. consumer. I'm not traveling anywhere, so I have more money in my pocket. I'm buying a lot of stuff online.
Right.
Manufacturing that initially shut down completely in Asia. And then, you know, China was like the first one out of the real risky COVID. And once they suddenly cranked it back up and started pushing a lot of product into the U.S., you had the shipping volatility where carriers went from having blank sailings, furloughing personnel, putting ships in cold layup to 5 or 6 months later having unprecedented volumes. You have port worker shortage. The ports, as much as they did to protect the health and safety of their workers when they were at work, it's hard to control the health and safety of your port workers when they're at home. So inevitably, COVID-19 struck the workforce. They had less workers at probably the most significant time when they needed the most. Containers were scarce. As you know, a lot of the containers that are used in the global transportation come from China. And so there was a shortage of those, as well as in some cases chassis. You had trucking issues where early in the pandemic, you had some truckers, especially independent truckers, that couldn't survive didn't make it through the early days. And then again, the same issues with workers' health and things, where you had fewer truckers once the volume started to kick up again. And you have some serious driver pay issues happening in the trucking industry. So they're hard pressed to get the truckers that they need. And then I think this last point is pretty interesting. Air cargo was an alternative, right? Mm-hmm. But it had fewer, passenger flights, which double in the underbelly of the ships as relief valves for air freight. So you had fewer passenger flights to, you know, use that relief valve. So you just had a combination of factors, the perfect storm, if you will, that have led to the situation that we're now in today.
Okay. All right. Yeah, there's a lot going on. And speaking of things coming up in terms of what's going on, will be our peak season. This year could be somewhat different than last year's, because as you said, the manufacturing shut down, and then when things booted up again, it created kind of a whirlwind. How do you think the 2021 peak could shake out? Do you think it could be along the lines of something more traditional that, like we've seen in the past prior to 2020, or is it going to be kind of a frenzy again, if you will?
You know, I wish I knew. To be candid, if I knew that, I'd probably be an analyst for some Wall Street firm with a house out in the Hamptons.
Yeah, right.
But I think it's a great question. I would say I think we all clamor for what we knew as normalcy. So we'd sort of love the traditional peak season because we know it and we understand it. I'm just not so sure that's what we're going to get. You know, one thing I'll tell you about the logistics industry writ large, and within that, you know, the port industry specifically, I think the industry are historically masters at flexing and fitting the proverbial 11th gallon into that 10 gallon can. They find ways to stretch in order to get the job done. I think the problem is over time, if you keep stretching that rubber band too many times, it eventually breaks. And now I come back to infrastructure, investment in our port infrastructure. It's been neglected for decades. Mm-hmm. And it's time. And I know there's many concerns about the amount of spending being advocated in a lot of the bills that have already gone through and the ones that are still being discussed. But I think this kind of investment that we're talking about in our port and intermodal network will pay back two or three times over time. So we need it. It's been deferred for way too long. You know, if you don't fix things in your house for too long, eventually it costs you way more money than it would have cost if you had addressed it early on. And that's the point we're at right now.
Yeah, it's never fun to learn the hard way, to say the least. And just wrapping up, Chris, I just one big theme among ports when they come out with their monthly volume results and their press releases, a lot is being made of the ongoing container shortage or imbalance, if you will. And obviously that kind of factors into everything when we talk about the import boom, congestion, et cetera. How are your members, what are your members saying about that, the container shortage situation? And what are some ways perhaps maybe down the road, if things do end up normalizing a bit, to sort of counter it?
Well, I'm not exactly sure the context of your question, but clearly there's an issue with, in particularly, U.S. exporters getting access to container equipment in order. So, okay, so you're coming.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant. As it relates to exports. My bad.
Yeah. So this is a serious issue, and it's one the Federal Maritime Commission has taken note of. I would say to you, it's a little bit of an uncomfortable situation for ports because at the end of the day, let's say that container that needs to go to, you know, Des Moines, Iowa to load an export load being dispatched there or not is absolutely not the decision of a port operator or a port authority. It's the decision of the ocean carrier who either owns or leases that equipment and who's deciding whether or not they want to dispatch that equipment to Des Moines or send it empty back to China or Japan in order to get another revenue load back in. But I think the ports are painfully aware of that. And there are efforts being made just to convene, you know, all the commercial interest, you know, in the supply chain to try to find some longer term resolution. And as I'm sure you're well aware, and as I alluded to before, the FMC is paying particular attention to that. But at the end of the day, I think the ports have a role to convene all interested in parties, but we don't have the levers to dictate commercial policy that the ocean carriers can use in their operations.
Right. Understood. All right, listen, Chris, this has been great. It brings us to the end of our allotted time for today's podcast. So on behalf of Logistics Management Magazine and the Peerless Media Supply Chain Group, I'd like to offer up a big thanks to you and the AAPA for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And for everyone out there listening, please be sure to give us to subscribe to our podcast, simply Supply Chain 24/7, wherever you get your podcast. And also feel free to give us a follow on Twitter at LogisticsMGMT. And also please be sure to give the AAPA some Twitter follows. And I got two handles here. One is at Ports United, and the other one is at AAPA_Seaports. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time.